Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, my name is Nathan Hobson, and I'll be the host of this episode of the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Today, I'm going to be talking with Professor Jennifer Dixon about her book, Dark Pasts, Changing the State's Story in Turkey and Japan, which was released from Cornell University Press in 2018. In this book, Dr. Dixon investigates the Japanese and Turkish states' narratives of their own dark pasts, namely the Nanjing Massacre and the Armenian Genocide. The official versions of histories initially put out there by both states was similar in adherence to a strategy of silencing critics or relativizing or denying the massacres, or in the case of Armenia, the genocide. But Dixon shows how the two governments' narratives of their dark pasts have diverged. The book draws on a combination of extensive fieldwork and archival research to present a holistic picture, not just of the narratives themselves, but of the domestic and international factors influencing when and how those historical myths about these large-scale atrocities have changed over time. Dark Pasts argues that while international pressures exerted on state actors like Turkey and Japan can and have produced change in the official versions of events, domestic factors are also crucial for shaping the content of these new versions of history. Dixon's work should be of interest to audiences not just in East Asian or Middle Eastern studies or political science, but also to those with particular concerns with historical memory. So Dr. Dixon, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your book. I'd like to just start off with the big question, right? Which is, what are dark pasts and why study them?
So first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm really pleased to be able to do a podcast interview with the New Books in East Asia series. So that's a great first question. So in my book, the title of the book is obviously Dark Pasts. And I define a dark past as a large-scale or systematic human rights atrocity that occurred in the past and for which the state in question bears some responsibility, either directly or as a successor to the regime that perpetrated the crimes. So large-scale or systematic human rights atrocities that would fall into this category include, but they're not limited to, genocide, mass killing, ethnic cleansing, colonialism, and slavery. So for the two cases that I study and analyze in my book, Turkey's narrative of the Armenian genocide, so that large-scale atrocity is categorized as a genocide, whereas the Nanjing Massacre is categorized as a mass killing. One thing I would want to emphasize is that Turkey and Japan are by no means in a small category of states with dark pasts. Rather, many, many states have dark pasts, including the United States. If we can think most prominently about the dark past of slavery and then the structural racism and discrimination that followed, and also the genocide, ethnic cleansing, and mass killing of Native Americans.
Thank you. Yeah. And so how did you get interested in studying this particular subject?
So I started out in grad school studying Turkish politics, and I was always rather interested in human rights issues, and this was one of the human rights issues that I was particularly interested in Turkey. And I would say I ended up picking this topic because I have a particular interest in stories and narratives and myths and silences and the traces that such stories and myths leave in the present. So I'm interested both on an individual level and then also in my book, obviously, I look at this on a macro or state level. So that kind of was the genesis of my interest. And then, you know, as a political scientist, my fields are comparative politics and international relations. And so I wanted to do a comparative analysis. So not just look at Turkey and its narrative of the Armenian genocide, but rather to look at it in comparison with another state's narrative. And so I spent some time trying to figure out what would make sense as a good comparison. And I ended up choosing Japan for a variety of analytical reasons.
Okay. And how did you originally become interested in Turkish politics?
It's rather idiosyncratic. My mom used to do business in Turkey. And so I went to Turkey with her several times. And I thought it would be fun to start studying Turkish afterward.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And then what was it about Japan that made you feel that it would be a good comparative for the Turkish situation?
Well, so there are several factors that I think make it a good comparison. So one is that both states' narratives have been rather sticky, to use a particular word. So they've both been rather resistant to change, and they've both been highly contested over time, both within the states, although to different degrees, and also internationally, although again to different degrees. So the question that I ask in my book is, when and why do states change their narratives of dark pasts? So I was first and foremost interested in cases where there was a lot of contestation and where that contestation was both within the domestic sphere and also on the international level, because I was interested in assessing the relative influence of these two different contestation at these two different levels. And then also I was interested in assessing the interaction between these two different spheres, et cetera. So on the broadest level, both cases kind of met this basic set of criteria of factors that needed to be present in the cases. Then from an analytical perspective, what's quite interesting about the two cases is that both states' narratives start from a baseline point that's quite similar. So they both start from a baseline point of silencing, and in the Turkish case, really active denial. Or silencing, I would say, is kind of the dominant position of both narratives at the beginning of the period of my analysis, which is in the immediate post-World War II period. And yet, over time, the two narratives diverge rather markedly. So while both are resistant to change, they both do change. And yet Japan's narrative changes to a much greater extent than Turkey's narrative does. So this allows me to both analyze changes over time within each state's narrative, but then also to analyze what factors differ in the two cases that might help explain the divergence in the trajectories of the two narratives over time.
Okay, great. Yeah, and that really sets us up to thinking about the chapters themselves. So your sort of top line analysis is about the domestic versus international factors that change these narratives. You lay out a conceptual framework for understanding all this in chapter one, which is changing the state's story. And could you explain your conceptual framework for us, and especially how it might differ from ways that other scholars have approached similar subjects?
Sure. So because I was studying states' narratives in my book, I needed, and I particularly was interested in accounting, understanding, identifying, understanding, and then explaining changes and continuities over time in these narratives. I needed to come up with a way to be able to identify the content of the narratives, and then more importantly, to be able to identify continuities and changes, right? So if I wanted to be able to explain change, I needed to actually be able to first identify when a change had happened. And I was also interested in studying official narratives in their whole. So not just in studying, say, what is said in textbooks, or not just in official statements and the question of is there an apology or not, but rather I wanted to bundle together a bunch of different possible indicators for a state's narrative to come up with, to be able to talk about the overall narrative kind of in its gestalt. So to both identify change and continuity and to look at the composite, I needed to come up with a conceptual framework. So I spent a lot of time thinking about how to do this and kind of working and reworking my framework. And so what I ended up coming up with is a conceptual framework that includes 8 possible elements of a state's narrative. And these 8 possible elements can, one or more of them can at any point in time, be part of the state's narrative. And so 5 of the elements are descriptive, and they range from denying or silencing the event all the way to admitting responsibility for the event. The other 3 elements of that I include in my conceptual framework are reparative. So they include apologizing, offering compensation, and commemorating. And so using this, these 8 elements, I define continuity as a period of time in which there's no change in the elements that constitute the official narrative. So at a given point in time, say in both Turkey's narrative and in Japan's narrative, the narrative constituted, so in Turkey's narrative, initially it constituted denying and silencing. And that persisted for about 3 decades at the beginning of my analysis. Japan's narrative started with denying and silencing and myth-making. And that persisted for about 2 decades at the beginning of my analysis. So change then, per my framework, is when one or more element is either added or subtracted from the official narrative. So that would be if, for instance, change would happen when a narrative the elements of the narrative begin to acknowledge the event in question, rather than just say myth-make or relativize or deny or silence. That would then constitute change in my framework. I guess I should take a step back and say kind of what are the texts or the media that I look at in order to identify these different elements. So I look at 5 main indicators, as kind of the parlance I use in the book. So one is official statements. Another is official state textbooks. So obviously not all countries' textbooks constitute or represent the state's position on an issue, but in both Turkey and Japan, textbooks are, curricula are written by the respective national ministries of education, and individual textbooks are approved by the national government. So textbooks in both Turkey and Japan can be taken to represent the state's position on these issues, or what's said in textbooks, I should say. So I also look at accounts in official publications and reparations and other payments to victim states, groups, or individual victims. So across, when I assessed the content of the state's narrative, I did so by considering whether and how the event in question was represented across these different indicators at a given point in time. So obviously this included subjective judgments on my part, and so I spent a lot of time considering exactly when a change could be said to have happened. So when a shift in one or more of the indicate in the content in one or more of the indicators was substantive enough to constitute a change according to my framework. So the framework differs, I would say, from many others' approaches to the study of the topic of memories or narratives of past events or historical wrongs in a couple of respects. So one, which I sort of alluded to, is the fact that I look at the official narrative as a whole rather than just at, say, official statements or at school textbooks or at museums or memorials or commemorative events. So I'm not the first person to look at official narratives in their whole, but this is distinct from a lot of other approaches. A second thing is that my definition of each of the elements in my conceptual framework is narrower and than a lot of others' approaches. So studies that seek to identify change over time more commonly identify the content of a state's narrative or its overall position in either two or three categories. So, for instance, as contrite or not contrite, whereas I have these eight different possible elements. So by having more possible elements or more categories, really, I'm able to identify change at a more granular and nuanced level. And I'm therefore also able to, I identify then more points of change, and I'm therefore able to, I have kind of more information to come up with an assessment of what drives changes and what drives continuities over time.
Okay, great. So now that we've we've been doing the big sort of meta issues about the analysis itself, I think that not all of our listeners are going to be familiar with the two incidents in question that are being narrated, these dark pasts themselves. Could you do us the favor of rehashing some of the core details of each of these incidents before we explore the ways that Japan and Turkey have changed their narratives over time, and so that we can also talk about what the sort of push and pull factors are and what's doing the instigating of the change in narrative and what's sort of shaping that narrative?
Good question. So the Armenian Genocide occurred in the context of World War I within the then Ottoman Empire. And it specifically, it occurred between 1915 and 1917. And the Armenian Genocide involved the forcible deportation and killing of the majority of Ottoman Armenian citizens of the Ottoman Empire. So Ottoman Armenians were a distinctive ethno-religious group within the overall population of the Ottoman Empire. And estimates of the number of Ottoman Armenians that were killed in the genocide range from about 800,000 to 1.5 million Ottoman Armenians. So really the vast majority of the overall Armenian population within the Ottoman Empire. And the genocide was orchestrated by the party, the central committee of the party that was in government in the Ottoman Empire. So it was orchestrated by key individuals within the government. And it was executed with the involvement of the military, the Ministry of the Interior, groups within Ottoman society, the Nanjing Massacre. So one key difference between the two cases, obviously, is that whereas the Armenian Genocide was a genocide, the Nanjing Massacre was not a genocide. It would be categorized as an event of mass killing. So the Nanjing Massacre occurred in 1937, and it occurred within the context of the Second Sino-Japanese War, which was fought between Imperial Japan and the Republic of China on the Chinese mainland. So the Second Sino-Japanese War unofficially began in 1931 and officially began in 1937, and it ended in 1945. In my analysis, I study, I focus on the Nanjing Massacre, but I actually analyze official characterizations of both the Nanjing Massacre and the broader Second Sino-Japanese War, because for many of the indicators that I look at, Japanese officials and different agencies in the Japanese government tend to, when asked questions about the Nanjing Massacre, to speak about the broader Second Sino-Japanese War. So they're really inextricably intertwined, and so I analyze them together, in a sense. So in the broader Second Sino-Japanese War, millions of Chinese citizens were killed. There were tens of thousands of Chinese women were raped in isolated incidents, and also in the comfort women system of forced prostitution organized by the Japanese military. About 40,000 Chinese men were forced into slave labor, and about 100,000 Chinese people were killed in the biological and chemical warfare programs organized by the Japanese military. Within the Nanjing Massacre itself, so the Nanjing Massacre began in December 1937 when the Japanese army invaded Nanking, which was then known as Nanjing, and it extended into early 1938. So during and after the capture of the city of Nanjing, which was then the capital of Chinese nationalist forces, Japanese soldiers burned much of the city. They killed an estimated 100 to 200,000 civilians and prisoners of war, and they raped an estimated 20,000 women. So those are synopses of the two events.
Yeah, thank you very much. And yeah, where do you go from there, right? But I guess I'd like to then sort of look at the narratives and get away from the events in that sense by looking at chapters 2 to 4, which deal in depth with the changing Turkish narrative. Chapter 2, the Armenian Genocide and its aftermath, explores the period from the genocide itself up to about 1950. Then chapter 3, from silencing to myth-making, 1950 to early 1990s. Chapter 4, playing hardball, 1994 to 2008, brings us all the way up to just a decade ago. So can you explain, can you talk about the Turkish narrative of the Armenian Genocide during these three periods that you've delineated, and explain some of the domestic and international factors in how that story changed or didn't?
So the period of analysis for both cases is from after World War II, after the end of World War II, to about to 2008. That's about when my research ended. So for Turkey's narrative, I started the analysis in 1950, which was the year of the first multi-party elections in Turkey. And over the period from 1950 to 2008, I identified four phases or four periods of continuity separated by three points of change. And over this period of time, the change in Turkey's narrative is notable. So one can definitely see real substantive change in Turkey's narrative, but it's still nevertheless quite limited in terms of the kind of the scope of the change. So in 1950, the overarching narrative was one was largely characterized by silence. So between 1950 and 1980, almost nothing was said about the Armenian Genocide, or as it was known or is still usually referred to as the quote unquote Armenian question within Turkey. So there was a blanket of silence within Turkey. Textbooks said nothing about the issue, and they said nothing even about Armenians' existence in the Ottoman Empire. So a Turkish student wouldn't know who Armenians were. They wouldn't know that Armenians constituted one of the Christian minority groups within the Ottoman Empire in this period between 1950 and 1980. Turkish officials said nothing. Books from outside the country were censored so that no books that referred to the genocide were allowed to come into the country and be sold within the country. And externally, Turkish officials only referred to the issue when they absolutely had to, when it came up in the context in relations with other countries, or when it came up in other countries. And in those contexts, Turkish officials typically said that this was an unfortunate part of the past, and it should be it should not be opened up, because that was only going to be that was only going to inflame relations and be bad. So they basically argued that it should be kind of swept under the carpet, and that that was better for everybody. The silence during this period was really perpetuated by Turkey's geostrategic position in the Cold War, and then also by constraints on domestic freedoms and the oppression of minorities domestically. The change, so the state's narrative first changed in 1981, and the substantive change that arose in 1981 was a shift from purely denying and silencing this past to also coming to myth make about and relativize this past. So to basically, Turkish officials they crafted an alternative story about what had happened during World War I to Ottoman Armenians. And they started to disseminate that domestically and internationally. The factors that triggered or brought about this change were international pressures, in particular, the emergence of two Armenian terrorist organizations in the mid-1970s that targeted, in particular, Turkish diplomats. And they did this in order to bring attention to Turkey's silencing and denial of the Armenian genocide, and to call for recognition of the genocide. The other factor internationally was the beginning of international recognition, or the bringing of international attention to the issue. And this was most notable in the UN. The issue came up. In the early 1970s, really, and persisted throughout the 1970s in a debate over whether a reference to the Armenian genocide should be included in a UN report. And also the beginning of attempts to pass resolutions in the US Congress to recognize the Armenian genocide. So all this started in the 1970s. And Turkish officials, particularly Turkish diplomats, they were repeatedly asked about this issue because Turkish diplomats were being assassinated, and it was coming up in the UN, and it was coming up in the United States. And Turkish diplomats didn't have very good answers to what, for instance, these terrorists were talking about. They didn't have a well-crafted story from the perspective of that would articulate the Turkish state's position on this issue. And yet change didn't actually happen until 1981. So all these factors really began to arise in the early 70s, but change didn't happen until the early 1980s. And the timing of the change was shaped by domestic factors within Turkey, in particular the fact that there was a military coup in late 1980. And so after the coup, Turkish diplomats, together with the Turkish military and other branches of the government, coordinated and work together to craft a new narrative that would kind of articulate the state's position about the issue that they could then disseminate externally and also disseminate domestically. And so then the reworked narrative that emerged in the early 1980s claimed that the charge of genocide was baseless, that claims of genocide were based on false propaganda by Armenians, that actually Armenians had been well treated under Ottoman rule and they'd only constituted a minority of the population, that Armenians had collaborated with the Ottoman Empire's enemies and that they'd rebelled during World War I, and that finally Armenians had actually committed massacres and atrocities against Ottoman Turkish citizens. This was disseminated, this new narrative was disseminated in Turkish high school history textbooks, in official publications that were published by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and by other kind of quasi-official institutions, and in official statements that were made domestically and that were made externally, so to international audiences. So the narrative, this narrative, this reworked narrative that was largely one of myth-making and relativizing alongside continued denial, really continued for about two decades. So there were subtle changes that arose after the end of the Cold War and the emergence of the state of Armenia, which I identify as a new phase, but the elements of the narrative didn't actually change, but rather the tone and the argumentation changed in the latter part of the 1990s. Then the third point of change that I identify came in 2001. And in 2001, again, the change arose in response to international pressures, and in particular in response to a wave of states recognizing or in a few cases attempting to recognize legislatively or in a couple of cases executively the Armenian genocide. And the kind of straws that broke the camel's back were a resolution that was considered in the U.S. Congress and almost passed that would have recognized the Armenian genocide and France's official recognition of the Armenian genocide. And so following these two final recognitions, Turkish officials, again in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the, in particular, the military and the National Security Council, which was kind of the peak organization in the military that had a large executive role in Turkish politics at the time, they together again worked to coordinate the reworking of the narrative and the dissemination of the reworked narrative domestically and internationally. And so the narrative is, as it was reworked from 2001, was the changes weren't as stark as the changes were in 1980. But the most notable change was that the official narrative could really no longer avoid acknowledging that that large numbers of Ottoman Armenians had died at the time. So that came to be acknowledged. But alongside this acknowledgement of the basic fact of large numbers of deaths was reworked efforts to relativize and downplay and myth make about these deaths. And so in particular, greater emphasis was placed on the fact that these deaths occurred in the context of what the Turkish state's narrative refers to as civil war or mutual massacre between Armenians and Turks. And the narrative even came to argue that that Armenians had committed a genocide against Muslims at the time rather than the other way around. One thing that I found really interesting about the change in the narrative at the time was that the narrative also adopted language of truth seeking and truth telling that scholars have referred to as stemming from the memory wave or the age of apology that's arisen over the past several decades. And so in a reflection of that, of the shifting in international expectations, Turkish officials in the mid-2000s started to argue that Turkey was ready to face the past, and that, in fact, Armenia was the one that was resistant to facing the past, and that facing the past and coming to terms with the past would be better for everybody. And as in the earlier period, this reworked narrative was disseminated in textbooks, in international communications, in publications published by various agencies of the Turkish government and by organizations affiliated with the Turkish government, and was coordinated by a committee that was established that was co-headed by the foreign minister and the head of the National Security Council. And so we have really three points of change, two significant points of change over the 58-year period of the analysis, and a shift from silencing and denial to myth-making and relativizing and very limited acknowledgement of deaths, but not the nature of the deaths or responsibility for the deaths.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you contrast that with the Japanese narrative, which you take up in the remaining chapters of the book, chapters 5 to 7. In chapter 5, the Nanjing Massacre and the Second Sino-Japanese War, you begin with the massacre itself, and you cover the period through the end of the American occupation in 1952. And then in chapter 6, History's Issues in the Post-War Period, 1952 to 1989, you take us up to the end of the Cold War, also the year of the death of the Showa Emperor. And then in chapter 7, Unfreezing the Question of History, 1990 to 2008, as you did with Turkey, you bring us up to 2008. Can you give us the sort of contours, the outline of the Japanese official story during those periods, and how and why it did change, and what divergences you see from the way that the Turkish narrative evolved?
Yes. So one slight difference between the two cases is that my analysis of Japan's narrative started in 1952 rather than in 1950. And this was because the U.S. occupation of Japan ended in 1952, so it didn't make sense to analyze the state's narrative when the state wasn't a sovereign state. So my analysis of Japan's narrative began in 1952 and extends to 2008, which is roughly when my research ended. And over this period of 56 years, I identify six phases, so six periods of continuity, and five points of change. So I identify more discrete changes in Japan's narrative than in Turkey's narrative. Moreover, the change in Japan's narrative, the scope of the change in Japan's narrative is greater than the scope of the change in Turkey's narrative. So in the period, in the first phase that I identify in Japan's narrative, which is from 1952 to 1971, the narrative was largely one of denial or silencing, myth-making, and relativizing. So that's a that that's kind of a starting point that's very similar to turkeys, although there was much more that was said. So turkeys was largely one of a blanket of silence, whereas Japan's narrative involved much more myth-making and relativizing alongside silences. And the last phase that I identify, so from the death of the Showa Emperor through, sorry, no, not then, from 1998 through 2008, so basically a decade, that narrative range included a number of elements. And so this kind of illustrates how the conceptual framework allows one to capture really divergent threads within an overall narrative. And so it included both myth-making and relativizing, but also acknowledging harm, expressing regret, admitting responsibility, and apologizing. So across the various indicators of Japan's narrative, these five elements in the conceptual framework were all represented. And so this is a much greater degree of change in Japan's narrative than in Turkey's narrative. One significant, there are a number of, I would say, factors that account for the diverging trajectory of the two narratives and the greater degree of change in Japan's narrative compared to Turkey's narrative. So one factor is stems from international pressure. So the argument that I make in my book, kind of the high level argument, is that international pressures are more likely to trigger change, but domestic considerations shape the content of that change. And so in Japan's, in the case of Japan compared to the case of Turkey, there was a much greater degree of international pressures on Japan about its representation of both the Nanjing Massacre and the Second Sino-Japanese War compared to on Turkey. So one, the representative quote unquote victim state for the Japanese case or for Japan is China, whereas for Turkey, it's Armenia. Over the period of analysis, China's power grew notably, as we know. China today, but really for the entire period of analysis, was relatively speaking more powerful than Armenia was relative to Turkey. Another difference is that for much of the period of analysis, Turkey and actually for the entire period of analysis, Turkey and Armenia had no formal diplomatic relations, and that continues today. In contrast, Japan and China normalized relations in 1971. So for much of the period of analysis, or for at least the latter four decades of the period of analysis, Japan and China had diplomatic relations. So that allowed Turkey was much easier for Turkey to disregard or dismiss any statements or attempts at calls for recognition coming from Armenia, whereas that was more difficult in Japan's relations with China. Another difference in terms of international pressures is that Japan has really faced a constellation of victim states. So while China is the primary victim state on the issue of the Second Sino-Japanese War, Taiwan is also, and then South Korea and other Asian countries have all, at points of time, called on Japan to change how it represents various aspects of either the Second Sino-Japanese War or policies within the broader Asia-Pacific War or characterizations of the overarching war. And so this broader constellation or enlarged set of victim states has increased the pressures on Japan at points of time. So One of the reasons why then there's a kind of greater degree of change in Japan's narrative compared to Turkey's narrative is because of the greater power of the relevant victim state, the normal diplomatic relations that existed between the two states, and the larger number of victim states. Domestically, there's several factors that that also differ between the two cases and that account for the much greater degree of change in Japan's narrative compared to Turkey's narrative. So one factor I emphasize is that concerns about the possibility of demands for compensation or territory shape officials' willingness to consider making change or changing their narrative. And so I argue that the greater the extent to which officials fear or are concerned that they might face calls for compensation or territory, the less willing they are to change their narrative in the direction of greater acknowledgement and greater contrition. And so both Turkish officials and Japanese officials have had what I refer to as material concerns that have accounted for some of their resistance to change, but change in the direction of greater acknowledgement and greater contrition. But I argue that Turkish officials' concerns about demands for compensation and territory were greater than Japan's concerns. Which is not to say that Japan didn't also have similar concerns. So one source of the difference is that in terms of concerns about compensation claims, Japanese officials have been able to rely on legal defenses that Turkish officials haven't had. So both Taiwan and China gave up their rights to claim compensation in 1951 and 1972, respectively. While it's not clear in these respective treaties that the giving up of compensation claims also included the issue of individual compensation, Japanese officials have consistently argued that it does refer to also individual compensation claims. And so Japanese officials have consistently argued that the question of compensation has been settled. And while Japanese officials have still been concerned about individual compensation claims and the potential that that it's not settled in everybody's eyes, they've at least had an argument that they could make, and they've had legal documents that they could refer to that bolster that argument. Turkey hasn't had a similar legal defense that it's been able to marshal. And so concerns about potential compensation claims have been greater and more dominant in Turkish officials' perceptions. In addition, both Turkey and Japan have territorial concerns that are part of their reservations or resistance to greater acknowledgement and contrition, and have been the case over time. But in Turkey, the territories that have been in question are central parts of Turkish territory and involve very valuable properties, including the former president's estate, which used to be owned by a wealthy Ottoman Armenian, and Incirlik Air Base, which is the air base from which the United States waged a lot of its, it was very useful in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. That territory also used to be owned by Ottoman Armenians. And so Turkish officials have long been concerned about the potential for large-scale territorial claims, but also for the potential for a host of individual claims for territories and properties to be returned or compensation on the basis of those. In contrast, the territories in question for Japan are not part of Japan's main islands. So while the contested territories with China, with the Republic of Korea, and with Russia have been serious issues in bilateral relations, and while there are potentially large economic rents to be gained from the territories that are disputed. These aren't part of the main islands. So symbolically and ideationally, I argue that they're not as central and therefore not as significant of a concern as these concerns have been for Turkish officials. I also identify legitimacy and identity concerns as an element that accounts for, that shapes officials' willingness to consider changing their narrative. And I argue that that the greater the extent to which the state's narrative connects with sources of legitimacy and identity for the state, its institutions, and its officials, the less likely officials are to be willing to consider changing the narrative in the direction of acknowledgement, greater acknowledgement and contrition. And so while for both Turkey and Japan, these events have connected with conceptions of each state's identity, they again have the Armenian Genocide connects much more centrally with the official representation of Turkish national identity and with the state's narrative of the founding of the Turkish state. In addition, another kind of ideational difference between the two is that while in Japanese politics, the issue of history issues, broadly speaking, and representations of the Second Sino-Japanese War, the Pacific War, and the Nanjing Massacre, they've fallen really along the fault line between liberals and conservatives within Japanese politics. So for these two kind of different groups on the political spectrum, the issue has been used in been understood in different ways to say something about Japanese national identity. In contrast, in Turkey, the issue of the Armenian Genocide really lies, it has been constructed as lying on the fault line between domestic politics and international politics. So that the Armenian Genocide is represented as something against which ordinary Turks need to defend the nation, and as another example of the many instances in Turkish history in which actors outside of Turkey sought to undermine its unity and its sovereignty. And so ideationally, this has made the stakes of change for the Armenian Genocide higher than the stakes of change overall for the Nanjing Massacre for Japan. The other source of difference in the trajectory of the two narratives has been the extent and direction of domestic contestation over these issues. So in Japan, there's been a much longer standing and more extensive pattern of contestation of history issues, broadly speaking, of the representation of the war and the Nanjing Massacre more specifically. So one can trace domestic contestation over history issues all the way back to the early 1950s. Whereas in Turkey, domestic contestation has been much more limited, and there have been more formal constraints. So in Japan, the constraints over discussion of these issues and contestation of history issues have been largely informal. So deriving from social pressures and deriving from the highly vocal and intimidating right-wing nationalist fringe. Whereas in Turkey, there have actually been formal constraints on that have limited individuals' ability and willingness to speak about these issues because they risked being arrested and charged with insulting the memory of Ataturk, insulting the state, etc. So over time, then, there's been, broadly speaking, a higher degree of international pressure on Japanese officials to change their narrative, a higher degree of domestic contestation in Japan over these issues, and relatively speaking, lower levels of constraints deriving from domestic considerations on Japanese officials versus on Turkish officials. And all this accounts for the greater degree of change over time in Japan's narrative compared to Turkey's narrative. The one other thing, I would just add one other thing, which is that because of the relatively speaking lower levels of resistance deriving from lower values on these different domestic considerations that I identify, the changes in Japan's narrative have been somewhat more disaggregated and spread over time than has been the case in Turkey's narrative. So because Turkish officials have perceived the stakes, the material stakes and the ideational stakes to be existentially threatening to a really extreme degree, they've been extremely resistant to acknowledging the extent of harm and certainly to acknowledging the nature of the harms or responsibility. And so they've been very resistant to change. And when change has happened, it's been really extensive and thoroughgoing. So kind of across all the indicators that I looked at. In contrast, in Japan's narrative, changes have been somewhat more disaggregated. So that that at some points of time, there were changes in the content, in how the Nanjing Massacre was represented in textbooks. But not changes, say, in official statements. And then at other points in time, there were changes in official statements or in commemorative activities, but not in other indicators. And this, I argue, is a reflection of the, relatively speaking, lower stakes for Japanese officials, so that change is thought of in somewhat more pragmatic and less extreme existential terms for Japanese officials compared to Turkish officials.
Yeah, thank you for giving us a really detailed comparison of the ways that the two narratives have changed. I wonder if, sort of by way of wrapping up here, you could talk a little bit about what, if any, sort of broader implications or lessons could be learned for considering other similar instances where states are grappling with dark pasts, be they sort of human rights atrocities or other kinds of historical issues.
Great. So there are four key insights that I would take away, that I take away from my analysis about, more broadly speaking, the politics of memory in relation to dark pasts. So one is that I find that states' narratives, there's no simple formula for when and why states change their narratives. Like, you can't say, if this, then this. Rather, I find that changes in states' narratives arise from highly interactive and contingent processes. I emphasize both the interaction between considerations at the international level and considerations at the domestic level as being really essential to understanding the changes that do arise at any given point in time. So I find first and foremost, right, that there's no simple, if one pressures a state in this way, then you will get change in this way, right? That's just not realistic. And I'm sure you would find that to be obvious given that you're a historian, right? The second finding is about the nature of change in states' narratives. So I find that, one, states' narratives are prone toward continuity and inertia. Two, that when change does occur, it's typically incremental, and it often involves layering, whereby new themes are added on to existing ones. So in both cases, the language of the state's narrative changes in very incremental and layered ways, right? So it's rare that an argument or theme from the narrative is completely discarded and a radically different one emerges. Rather, What's much more common is for new themes to be layered on top of existing ones, or for a subtle change to be made in an argument or aspect of the state's narrative. And the third insight I find about the, or derive about the nature of change, is that change is often multifaceted and sometimes ambivalent. So as I mentioned, the last phase that I identify in Japan's narrative includes both myth-making and relativizing and apologizing, right? So that range in the narrative at one point in time really underscores the sometimes very ambivalent nature of a state's narrative at a single point in time. Similarly, Turkey's narrative in the last phase of my analysis is similarly ambivalent, right? So that after 2001, the state's narrative came to acknowledge, that a few hundred thousand Ottoman Armenians had died, but also began to make new arguments that relativized these deaths, that presented an alternative narrative of these deaths, and that sought to downplay the importance of these deaths. So both narratives indicate the multifaceted nature of change and the sometimes ambivalent nature of change in states' narratives. Another, I would say, contribution is the conceptual framework that I developed for the book, which my hope is that others might find it useful for analyzing other states' narratives, either over time or in comparison. And then finally, one thing that I haven't said that much about in the interview with you today, but that is one of the strands in the book, is that I talk about international norms and the ways in which the complexities of their impact and the range of responses to normative expectations. And in particular, in the book, I pay attention to changing expectations related to truth-seeking and truth-telling in relation to both countries. And then in relation to Turkey's narrative in particular, the changing strength of the norm against genocide and kind of changing understandings, both from a scholarly perspective and from a legal perspective of genocide, and how those have factored into the ways in which Turkish officials have sought to reframe the nature of the event. So all of these insights I think and hope others would find applicable to other cases.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you for spending some time with us today to talk about your book. And I'm looking forward to hearing from you again when something new comes out.
Thank you again for inviting me to do this interview and for the great questions. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care.